This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about what may be the nation's first law legalizing direct action. A small township in Indiana County, Pennsylvania, passed an ordinance permitting nonviolent direct action aimed at stopping local frack wastewater injection wells.
We'll also speak with American Civil Liberties Union Voting Rights Project attorney Julie Ebenstein, who got the North Carolina voting restrictions thrown out in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals 2 weeks ago. And last, we speak with Canadian criminal defense attorney Marilyn Sanford, who successfully and for the first time got an entrapment defense honored in British Columbia. Fear no longer works in that section of North America.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In what is perhaps the nation's first law legalizing direct action, Grant Township in Indiana County, Pennsylvania, passed an ordinance permitting nonviolent direct action aimed at stopping local frack wastewater injection wells. Pennsylvania General Energy Company has sued the township to overturn this local democratically enacted law that prohibits injection wells. In 2013, residents in the township learned that PGE was applying for permits that would legalize the injection well. Despite hearings, public comments, and permit appeals demonstrating widespread residents' opposition to the project, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency nonetheless issued a permit to PGE. In response, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, along with Grant Township supervisors, passed an ordinance the next year. It established rights to clean air and water and the right to local community self-government. If a court fails to uphold citizens' right to stop corporate activities threatening the community's well-being, the ordinance provides, quote, that any natural person may then enforce the rights and prohibitions of the charter through direct action. It also says that any nonviolent direct action to enforce their charter is protected from any legal actions brought by private or public entities. Joining us to discuss how the ordinance came to be passed and the status of community opposition to the fracking are community organizer Chad Nicholson and Grant Township Supervisor Stacy Long. Welcome, Chad and Stacy, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Stacy, you're on record as saying that you're tired of being told by corporations and regulatory agencies that community residents can't stop this proposed fracking injection well. Can you give us a brief history about PGE, the energy company, and their plan to bring toxic wastewater into your area?
I can. I can tell you that PGE is short for Pennsylvania General Energy. They are a privately held company based out of Warren, Pennsylvania. They only do business in Pennsylvania, mostly fracking. Their proposed injection well that would happen here in Grant Township is their first Class 2D injection well. They've never done this before. They regularly truck their fracking wastewater to Ohio, and they were seeking a less expensive method and solution to trucking their fluids to Ohio. So they are going to repurpose, well, what they want to do is repurpose a gas well here in Grant Township to become an injection well.
And what was the response locally from residents? Did PGE come and hold public meetings?
Well, initially how this works in Pennsylvania, in any case, the EPA oversights the Underground Injection Control Program, and the EPA had a hearing. That's the law. That's how they do it. And we had about 40 residents attend that hearing along with the owner and I think maybe another fellow from PGE. And that would have been in October of 2013.
And when you talk about the owner, do you mean the landowner where this would actually take place?
No, I mean the actual owner of Pennsylvania General Energy.
Ah. And yeah. In terms of the property where it would take place, is that public land or is it private?
It's private land.
And so the owners have given permission for this to occur there?
That is correct.
tell us a bit about the beginning of community opposition.
Well, Grant Township is very small. The entirety of Grant Township is a watershed, which means we are very, very water rich. Every single household, and that's about 250 households, as there are no businesses or any industry, nothing goes on in Grant Township. People just live here. We all have a private well or spring as our only source of water. There is no public water in Grant Township. It is not going to happen. And if I may add, the Safe Water Drinking Act does not apply to any of us.
Why is
so
that?
So if something were to go horribly wrong, you know, there would be a large percentage of us without water.
And why doesn't it apply to you?
Because the Safe Water Drinking Act only applies to public sources
of
water.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
Chad, what was your role in getting involved in creating the ordinance at issue? And what specifically does the ordinance say?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of ordinances and a home rule charter at this point that have been adopted in Grant Township that we have been involved with. And to back up a bit to where Stacy started the story, with the hearing in the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, in late 2013, even though there was a lot of community opposition, Stacy mentioned 40 people came out to that hearing, which in a township of 250 people is significant.
700 people, Chad.
Yeah, it's 250 households.
Yeah, right.
And so the EPA, despite the community opposition, ended up issuing the permit for the injection well anyways. And it was at that point that residents from the community, Stacy and a group called the East Run Hellbender Society, which is a citizens group within the community, contacted our law firm for help, basically saying, look, you know, we have done everything right. We went out to the hearings. We have appealed the permit. We've expressed our opposition. We think this is a bad idea. It's going to bring toxic waste into the community. We're on private wells. And this corporation has a history of permit violations in Pennsylvania, and yet they're still issuing the permit to this corporation. What else can we do? Basically, what they found is that we're currently living in a system of law that privileges harmful corporate interests above the health and safety of our communities. And so I came out to a public meeting at the request of the residents of the township, explained how this system of law works, and expressed that we would be willing as a law firm to work with them to draft a local law called the Community Bill of Rights that would be about asserting the rights of the people of the community to govern themselves and about asserting the right of the people to actually protect themselves from harmful corporate activities. It was at that point that the supervisors and the community group decided to work with us. We went back and forth on drafts, and it was in June of 2014 that the first ordinance was passed in Grant Township that prohibited the injection well as a violation of the civil and political rights of the people living within the township. So that was a couple of years ago, and that was our first involvement.
After you passed that, what, if any, was a response from PGE, or did they know about this? Did you give them notice?
Actually, yes, we did give them notice, and PGE was very alarmed, and at the public township meeting, where the current board of supervisors were, you know, proposing to vote on whether or not to pass the ordinance, PGE did show up with a troop of lawyers to that meeting, along with about 50 residents. And our board of supervisors passed the ordinance in front of them anyway, even after they had threatened publicly to sue the township.
And did they in fact sue the township?
They did indeed, 2 months later.
And on what grounds was the lawsuit brought?
Yeah, they brought the lawsuit on a number of grounds, ones that we anticipated. There was, I believe, a 13-count complaint. They break down into three broad categories. The first category is that the corporation's claiming that the local ordinance violated their corporate constitutional rights under the First Amendment, Fifth Amendment, 14th Amendment. Folks may be familiar, corporations have personhood rights conferred on them by the Supreme Court at this point. And so they were claiming that this ordinance violated their constitutional rights by not allowing them to inject. So that's the first category. The second category is that PGE claims that the municipality was preempted from passing a law like this, that it was not a matter of local concern. that the oil and gas activities, such as this proposed injection well, are governed under the Oil and Gas Act in Pennsylvania, a state-level law, and so that because it was a state-level law that was going to allow this to occur, that the municipality, the locality, was preempted by the state from passing a ban on the injection well. And then the third category is that the corporation claimed that the municipality lacked the authority under the second-class township code to adopt laws like the one that they did. So Grant Township had been what's called a second-class township that usually elicits cackles from people, because it's true, these townships are called second-class, and people living in them often feel like second-class citizens because they are routinely told by corporations such as PGE that they don't have the authority to adopt laws that are in the best interest of the community. So the second-class township code is basically an administrative book handed out by the state that tells the municipalities what they can and can't do. And PGE claimed that the passage of this ordinance prohibiting the injection well exceeded the authority that was given to the second-class townships by the state code. So just to sum, there's three broad categories: that PGE's constitutional rights were violated, that the state preempted the municipality from adopting laws on things like injection wells, and that the municipality itself lacked the authority to adopt laws. So they brought the complaints, as Stacey mentioned, just a couple of months after the ordinance was passed, and there's been a number of maneuvers in that case. We're actually still litigating parts of it today, which I'm happy to get into if there's interest.
Yeah, Chad, I'm interested. What were your responses to those three broad areas? Because I would think that the harm that you could demonstrate from fracking in other localities would be a strong argument that might counter their constitutional claims.
Sure. And we actually filed on behalf of the township counterclaim, sued the corporation back, saying that the corporation's lawsuit violated the community's right to local self-government. So within the ordinance that was passed in June 2014, it contained a Bill of Rights for the community. It said there's a right to local self-government, a right to clean air, a right to pure water, rights for nature and ecosystems. Actually laid out a new Bill of Rights for the community and prohibited the injection well as a violation of those rights. So we filed a counterclaim back against the corporation, but we also made a number of other arguments, which is that, as you mentioned, these are harmful, demonstrably harmful activities. And for a corporation to be able to claim to use state and federal constitutional protections to shield themselves from democratic lawmaking that is trying to protect the community is about the most absurd mockery of any form of democracy that we can think of. And so we challenge their claims, basically saying that corporations have certain rights and protections, but they're ultimately creatures of the state. Corporations don't exist without permission from the state legislature to exist in the form of a charter that's issued to them. And so how can a corporation, which is actually created in the name of the people of the state, then use state law and state powers to override and deny the rights of the people in the communities that they're trying to do business? So we challenged all of those doctrines frontally, basically saying corporations don't have the right to clothe themselves in the Constitution when they would be using those powers to try to deny the rights of the community that they're wanting to do business within. And we're also saying, of course, the community should have the authority to adopt laws that are in their best interest to protect the health and safety of the community. And it's a gross absurdity to say that communities lack the authority to adopt laws that are in the best interest of the community. So we challenged all those doctrines that PGE brought in that complaint and said this is not any vision or ideal of democracy, and this is about actually challenging the laws that corporations are currently using to force unwanted harmful activities on the communities.
This is such a wonderful example for other municipalities. Where are you in the case now?
I'll do my best to sum it up. There's been, I believe, over a couple of hundred filings at this point. It's been very complex, and I'll spare you and listeners most of the sordid details. But to say that in October of 2015, so a little over a year after the case was originally initiated by PGE, a federal judge in the Western District of Pennsylvania stripped out parts of that ordinance. So October of 2015, last year, a judge stripped out parts of the ordinance, agreeing with PGE that the municipality lacked the authority to adopt the ordinance. So she stripped out parts of the ordinance that she felt were beyond the authority of the community to pass. Essentially, that invalidated most of the operative parts of the ordinance. However, 3 weeks later, in November of 2015, voters in Grant Township actually changed their form of government to become what's called a home rule municipality. Home Rule is a municipal designation in Pennsylvania that's available to all municipalities. There's about 2,500 total municipalities in Pennsylvania. Only about 70 have pursued Home Rule. What Home Rule does is it takes the community out from underneath the second class township code that I mentioned earlier,
right,
and it actually elevates the community to the status of Home Rule, which basically allows them to write a local charter. It's a local constitution, and that local charter, that local constitution, is then democratically enacted by the people. So it's not the series of rules and regulations that's been handed down by the state that tells the people in the community what they can and can't do. It's actually the people coming together to form their own constitution, their own set of governing operations and rules and procedures themselves that are in the best interest of the community. And they adopted that again in November of 2015 and reinstated the ban on injection wells that the judge had overturned just 3 weeks earlier. So they looked at the judge's decision and said, we feel that's illegitimate. The courts don't have the authority to deny us our rights and to allow corporations to come in and place harmful activities in our communities against our rights. So they actually reinstated the ban with the adoption of the Home Rule Charter. That was 3 weeks after the judge's decision last year.
Wow.
The ordinance case is still ongoing. So we now have a charter in place in the township, but we're still litigating some parts of the original complaint over the ordinance because the judge basically only ruled on the second-class township aspects of the complaint. PGE is now asking for a ruling on the corporate constitutional rights of that complaint, and the judge is still basically mulling those over today. So that case is ongoing. The Home Rule Charter is in place. The litigation over the ordinance is still in place. And it's a very complex situation, but in short, the people of Grant Township still have a democratically enacted law to protect their rights in place. They looked at the judge's decision and said, that's illegitimate. We're going to have to continue to take more actions to make sure that our rights are protected in the community if the state or the federal courts won't do it.
Now, one clarifying question. With this home rule, did that mean you had to amend your countersuit?
No, from our perspective, those are two totally different things. Litigation over the ordinance is separate from litigation over the Home Rule Charter,
right,
of which there currently is no litigation going on regarding the charter. As well, when you pass a Home Rule Charter, the charter itself takes on the force of state statutory law. So it actually rips out a lot of the complaints that PGE made in their first complaint because when you have a Home Rule Charter, it's basically the same status under the law as the Oil and Gas Act. So now you have a conflict between two state-level laws, the Charter and the Oil and Gas Act, or any other number of laws that have not actually been litigated at this point, but it's a whole new legal framework to argue.
Right, and not to get too complicated, but given this change in status, I'm just curious, does that automatically make invalid those portions of the judge's earlier rulings?
From our perspective, it makes them irrelevant.
Right.
Because the judge's decision was based on the authority of the municipality to make decisions as a second-class township. Well, they're no longer a second-class township. They're now a home rule municipality.
Got it. Now, Stacy, can you give us just a brief picture of what kind of direct action residents have, in fact, engaged in over the past couple of years?
Well, I can tell you that it's not been needed because the activity is not taking place in Grant Township. So there has been no act of direct action. Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, I guess the fact that the ordinance then is sort of there to protect any future direct action?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay.
Absolutely correct. And we are being trained because obviously, we want to make sure that we are protecting our rights in, a safe manner, and anyone who would be willing to stand with Grant Township and our residents, we want that person or group of people to be utterly protected.
Now, in terms of the time frame for when PGA wants to start drilling, when is that?
Well, they still do not have their Department of Environmental Protection permit here in Pennsylvania, and they must have that permit. So there's been no activity at the site.
Oh, okay. So they weren't issued a permit. I misunderstood there.
Yeah, actually,
okay.
I could have clarified. This particular project requires that PGE get a permit from the EPA and the Pennsylvania DEP. The EPA did grant them the permit despite our appeal, and the DEP has not yet. Actually, we appealed. They initially granted their permit for about 2 months. We did appeal it, And then, for whatever reason, in March of 2015, the DEP revoked PGE's permit.
I see.
And
okay.
has not clarified when they would be doing something about it. I can also add that the DEP did hold a public hearing here in Grant Township with PGE in June of 2015.
I wanted to clarify that in some ways the ordinance that was originally passed, as well as the Home Rule Charter that has been now adopted, are forms of direct action themselves. They are coming in opposition to a structure of law that has told the people of Grant Township that they don't have the authority to stop this injection well. They're saying, we do have the authority, we're going to claim that authority, and we're going to choose to actually adopt laws that are about recognizing our rights and not listening to the state or the federal courts when they tell us that we can't. And so, in effect, those laws that have already been passed are forms of direct action. It's the community taking direct action to make sure that their rights and that their water are protected. And there has been one other ordinance passed, I'm going to mention it briefly, that since then, which was a couple of months ago, the supervisors passed an ordinance legalizing direct action within the community. So that's a third law that's now been passed. And it's related to what Stacy's saying, which is that if it at some point comes to community members needing to stop the trucks, that they want protections for people to be able to, in the community, enforce the rights and the prohibitions that are contained within their charter. So what the latest ordinance says is that public or private actors cannot bring charges against people who are engaging in nonviolent direct action to protect the rights of the community, and that if charges are brought by a public or private actor, that the relevant court needs to dismiss those charges without further filings. So, of course, this ordinance has not been tested yet, but it's about the community continuing to stay on the offensive and recognizing that if the courts don't protect the rights of the people, it will be up to the people themselves to protect their rights. And this was about the supervisor saying, you know, we need to be able to take action to give more protections to our community members to protect our rights if the courts will not.
I am so impressed with this community and with the supervisors, you included, Stacy.
There's lots of room here. We invite you to come to move to Grant Township.
Stacy, did you have anything to add in our remaining few minutes?
Well, actually, I do. I want to stress that living in a very tiny community like this, we do feel adrift from, you know, the big picture of what the state would want for us. And the state seems to be granting corporations a priority over tiny rural areas like mine, like that our area would serve as sort of a sacrificial zone for industry. This industry is not going to work for Grant Township. Grant Township is water rich, and we have to protect our water because otherwise, you know, our homes and everything, there's no value if the water is polluted. And I would also like to add that PGE consistently ranks within top 10 and top 20 frequently cited companies for the number of health and environmental violations. And that's been documented by the Pennsylvania DEP itself. And so, you know, a company like that, if they were a retail outlet, they would have gone under, you know, 10 years ago. But they keep managing to get permits. And it's not a good fit for Grant Township. So our community is saying, we don't want the activity, it's not a good fit, and we'll show you by a democracy that we're going to fight back.
What would you have to say about the Environmental Protection Agency and how they're fulfilling their mission?
Well, the EPA stands for Everything Permitted Anyway. It is not often that the EPA completely turns down a permit application. Isn't that right, Chad? I'm not incorrect in saying that.
Yes, and, you know, the other joke is that the Pennsylvania DEP, the so-called Department of Environmental Protection, is called the Department of Everything Permitted, or Don't Expect Protection. And, you know, that's, as an organization, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, we started out working with communities like Stacy's to appeal permits that had been issued by these regulatory agencies, because most of us have this belief that the EPA or the DEP are there to do what their name says, which is protect the environment. But that's actually not true. Their job is there to facilitate the permitting of business and industry. That's what they do. So the the regulations, the rules are usually written by corporations, corporate lobbyists. Those are then handed to the state legislatures. You know, you can watch the sausage get made. And then the state legislatures pass these rules and regulations to be implemented administratively by these regulatory agencies. There's a reason that they're called regulatory agencies, which is that they regulate harm. They regulate the rate or flow of harm associated with these corporate activities, and they then issue permits, which legalize, they permit something to happen that would otherwise be illegal. So they permit a certain amount of harm to go along with these activities. And so when we think that they're there to protect our communities, they're not. They're actually there to serve as a shield, a barrier between the communities and the corporation by issuing permits that allow that corporation to engage in harmful activity. And it actually legalizes harm to go along with that. So we have to be clear about what our regulatory agencies are. That's why our organization doesn't put any faith in them anymore, and we don't work with communities to do permit appeals, because 99% of the time, even if you fight through the regulatory system, you're still going to get the harm. You're just left ending up arguing over the terms. How much harm? Where's the well going to be placed? How many trucks per day? How much pollution? All that stuff. And we find that to be a losing argument and not actually the real issue, which is democratic decision making. Who makes decisions? The corporation, the regulatory agencies, or the people that live in the community that's going to receive the harm? That's the real question from our perspective.
Very well put, Chad. If listeners are interested in learning more about the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, do you have a website they can go to?
Yes, it is CELDF. So that's the first letter of each of those words, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.org. And I did want to say, in closing, from our perspective, that it has been an incredible honor to work with Stacy and the folks of the township. They're some of the bravest and most dedicated people that we've worked with across the country. And so kudos to them.
Oh, my.
Yes, Stacy, you are one of a kind. I'd like to just add that on Law and Disorder, we do try to focus as much as we can on ways that people can work in their communities to stand up to corporate dominance. And I think that this is one of the most outstanding examples that we've seen of how a small community has worked so creatively through your ordinances related to direct action to really continue to stand up for your rights and your democratic values. So we'd love to have you on again in a few months to see how things are progressing. But meanwhile, thank you and keep up the amazing work.
Thank you. It was a delicious honor to be here today.
Thank you. Have a great day, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
The great civil rights movement of the 1960s gave rise to the 1967 Voting Rights Act. It protected black citizens, many of them poor, when they sought to exercise their constitutional right to vote. Last month, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit invalidated voting restrictions in North Carolina that were described as targeting African Americans with almost surgical precision. In June of 2013, the Supreme Court removed a part of the Voting Rights Act, ruling that states with the longest histories of voting discrimination no longer needed to approve their voting changes with the federal government. Within a month of that decision, North Carolina passed the country's most restrictive voting laws. Those restrictions were recently overturned in violation of the Voting Rights Act and the 14th Amendment guaranteeing equal protection of the laws. We talk more about the background in the North Carolina voting rights case with Julie Eberstein, staff attorney with the ACLU Voting Rights Project. Julie is actively involved in litigating voting rights matters around the country, with cases in Kansas challenging the state dual registration system, Iowa challenging the state's felon disenfranchised laws, North Carolina challenging cutbacks to early voting and the elimination of same-day registration, and Ferguson, Missouri, challenging at-large school board elections. Attorney Julie Eberstein, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. You do good work. Tell us in the audience, what was the background to the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act?
Well, as everybody knows, in the U.S., there's a long history of racial discrimination in voting. And in the 60s at the time, there were still barriers to voting, particularly in southern states, but in a number of different states. So what the federal they passed federal law to prevent states from discriminating on the basis of race in voting, things like poll taxes and other devices that that prevented people from exercising their protected right to vote.
Was the 65 Voting Rights Act effective in promoting the franchise for black people?
In many ways it was, slowly, but one of the provisions of the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, and that's the one that was struck down by the Shelby County decision in 2013, what that required was that states seek preclearance from the federal government before they implement any law that affects voting. So what the Voting Rights Act did, which is fairly unique in federal law, is it required states to seek permission, in a sense. It kept a check on state governments to prevent them from discriminating based on race because of this federal law. In many ways, once that provision was rendered inoperative by the Supreme Court in 2013, there was lesser protection from the Voting Rights Act. There are still remaining provisions of the Act that protect against racial discrimination, but none have this pre-implementation requirement. So what we're left with now is a regime where Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act still protects against discrimination, but you can't bring a lawsuit, as we have in many cases since 2013, until after the law is implemented. And that means that elections at times can go forward or end up going forward despite a law that's under review by a federal court and being challenged as discriminatory. If you think about that, it's really disturbing that you would have an election under a law that's later determined to be racially discriminatory.
What was the background to the 2013 Supreme Court decision in Shelby County versus Holder, written by Chief Justice John Roberts, which gutted the Voting Rights Act? What was the background to that?
Well, I think you really need to go back to the 2008 election. What we saw during that historic election where we elected our first African-American president was an increase in turnout and an increase in the diversity of the electorate. You saw about a quarter of the voting population were people of color. You saw turnout for the first time narrow in its gap between different races. And so you saw a much more diverse, a much younger, and a much larger electorate than you've really ever seen before in this country. There was a backlash to that large success of democracy. A lot of states started to pass laws that would make it more difficult to vote. So instead of the political parties or legislators individually trying to reflect the new composition and the needs of voters, they wanted to pare down who actually did the voting and remain in their same lane as far as what sort of interests they represent. The problem in a lot of ways with states passing these voting laws, which they're constitutionally entitled to do, is you have state legislators who nearly always have a personal stake in the outcome of elections. For state legislators to tinker with the election administration regime is inevitably going to have an effect on them. So you can see how there's this conflict that federal law and the federal government wants to protect against. We saw this huge wave of suppressive legislation in Florida, in Texas, in Wisconsin, Ohio, and a number in Kansas, and a number of different states to erect new barriers to the right to vote. And we litigated a number of those, against a number of those laws, sometimes using Section 5, this preclearance regime that I talked about a moment ago, sometimes using other provisions of the Constitution or federal law. And we had some success in rolling back a few of those laws. Along comes the Shelby County decision in 2013. And in that decision, just as Robert said, voting discrimination still exists. Nobody doubts that. Now, if you look at that quote, it's disturbing to recognize that voting discrimination is still alive and well in 2013, yet you have the Supreme Court removing a strong protection against voting discrimination in the states.
So what did the state of North Carolina do after Roberts' decision? What did they do to restrict voting rights?
So what the state of North Carolina did is it passed, there's five main provisions that were at issue in the case. I think people use voter ID or photo ID as a shorthand for what they recognize to be a whole variety of barriers to voting. North Carolina passed a law that included a strict photo ID law. It removed a week of early voting. So instead of having 17 days for early voting, it had 10 days. It removed what's called out-of-precinct voting, which allowed people, if they couldn't find transportation or otherwise get to their assigned polling place, to go to another polling place that they could go to. It took away same-day registration, which allowed people to either register for the first time or to change their address or otherwise fix their registration during the early voting period. And it got rid of pre-registration, which let high school students, 16 and 17-year-olds, register in advance so once they turned 18, they would automatically be in the system.
Yeah, that's amazing. What did the court write to justify its opinion in overthrowing all those restrictions? What did they answer back to the state of North Carolina? What arguments did the judges use?
Well, the Fourth Circuit really gave a scathing rebuke to the legislator in North Carolina. I mean, you looked at the provisions that were targeted, and what the Fourth Circuit said was that provisions that had been effective in increasing black voters' turnout and in providing opportunities to vote were surgically removed from the state elections laws. And that wasn't an accident. Legislators asked for information, for racial data, on who used which voting provisions, and then removed the ones where there was a lean towards black voters using these provisions. That's incredible. The Fourth Circuit found that there was discriminatory intent behind passing the law. And, of course, the Constitution prohibits that. So the Fourth Circuit's decision, again, this didn't come out of the blue. We brought a lawsuit challenging this law the day it was implemented in August of 2013. So this case has been going on for quite some time. We had a 3-week trial over the summer last summer. The Fourth Circuit already heard it with a preliminary injunction motion. And now, finally, 3 years later, it has really come down very strongly to say that this can't be done, not in the wake of the Shelby County decision, not ever.
Well, you were part of the team that argued this.
Yes.
Did you get to go down there for the argument?
Oh, yes, I spent...
So what was it like?
It was exciting. You know, it's always interesting to be in a trial where you get to present fact evidence as well as legal arguments, and we heard from voters themselves. So we had individual clients who vote in North Carolina, who undertake to expand the vote through registering their neighbors. We represented unions, organizations. The NAACP is one of the plaintiffs in that lawsuit. There was a woman who's been profiled a bit, Rosanelle Eaton, who is 92 years old and remembers the previous devices that the state used to try to prevent her from voting. She came to every single day of that trial. It was exciting to be there and to hear from representatives of, well, not representatives, but regular citizens of North Carolina, allow them to be able to tell the judge what this voting law would do to them. 3 weeks in Winston-Salem, North Carolina in July was not everybody's first choice, but it was very exciting as far as attending the trial and being part of the trial.
So what protections remain as we sit here today, Julie?
Well, like I said, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is still operative, and it applies nationwide. And Section 2 really recognizes that a law that has a disparate effect on black voters and a link to prior historic discrimination cannot be allowed to go forward. And here's how that really works in practice. If I say that all voters need to go to this assigned polling places, but black voters in a particular state, because of prior redlining or other methods of historic discrimination, have less access to transportation and live in areas without public transportation, it's harder for them to get to the polls. If there's a higher illiteracy rate among black voters than white voters, and you pass a law that requires a level of literacy, that's disproportionately going to affect black voters, and it has a basis in our historically racially discriminatory past. So there, Section 2 provides a protection against that disproportionate effect on black voters. And then, of course, there is the constitutional protection. That takes a few different forms. There's constitutional protection against discrimination in voting, and that's the basis on which the Fourth Circuit ruled. But there are also laws that protect against burdening the right to vote as a fundamental right. And First Amendment rights sometimes are implicated. If a state passes a law, as Florida did in 2011, to say that there are restrictions on how individuals can engage with others to register them to vote, that impinges on their political speech and their First Amendment rights. There's a number of different provisions that still protect against intrusion into the voting process.
So how will these recent decisions impact on the 2016 elections?
Well, hopefully both the decisions protecting people's rights to vote and the attention that these decisions have received will encourage people to really get out there, register, make sure they're registered, make sure their registration is accurate, make sure their friends are registered, make sure everyone has a plan to get to the polls. I think it'll really, hopefully there will be a swing towards people feeling even more strongly about their desire to exercise their right to vote as they've watched it over the last three years be taken away by the very legislators that are supposed to represent them.
We're speaking with attorney Julie Ebenstein of the American Civil Liberties Union. She's on the team that successfully overthrew parts of the North Carolina law that suppressed voter participation. The ACLU is doing other litigation on this, I know, but bring us up to date on what else the ACLU is doing.
Well, the North Carolina case, the state will likely seek to stay that Fourth Circuit decision, and so we'll respond to that. There's a case in Wisconsin related to photo ID. There are four or five cases in Kansas related to the requirement that people provide documentation of their citizenship, not just what's the norm, which is a statement under penalty of perjury that they're a citizen. We really have lawsuits all over the country. Those are the fast-moving ones that will likely be resolved before the election.
You know, I'm from Wisconsin.
Oh, really?
So I've been following what's been going on there, which has been terrible. A once progressive state has been kind of taken over by these right-wing Republicans, guided politically and financed monetarily by the Koch brothers. Scott Walker is the governor there, and when they say jump, he says, how high? My question is, has this right-wing Koch brothers money and other billionaires who are not that happy about the exercise of the franchise, has that been used at all to influence these retrogressive laws in the various states?
It's hard for me to say the source of a lot of these laws outside of the legislators who passed them. What we do see is, like in North Carolina, there was a strong tie between party and race, a tie that the Fourth Circuit recognized. And what the Fourth Circuit said is you can't target black voters because they vote Democrat. So it's not a valid justification for the legislator to say, hey, we weren't discriminating on the basis of race. We were just discriminating on the basis of party registration. That's also not allowed in a state like North Carolina, which has a long and disturbing history of racially polarized voting and race discrimination. Otherwise, you get what happened in North Carolina, which is that every single black legislator votes against a bill and it passes anyway. So there's certainly some overlap in places like North Carolina and others between party and race, and using race as a proxy for disenfranchising people on the basis of their party registration. That's no more valid than targeting a particular racial group for any other reason. That's what the Fourth Circuit really said.
Julie, do you have any final thoughts for our audience before we say goodbye?
Just that it's been a very exciting few weeks for voting rights. We don't always have good news, so we were encouraged to get some in the last couple of weeks, and we're going to push on to keep protecting people's right to vote. I encourage everybody to exercise that right. The court cases are meaningless if people don't go out and use their right and vote, so I hope everyone will do that.
Well, thank you, Attorney Julie Ebenstein. from the ACLU for being on Law and Disorder, and good luck with some more victories.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
A Canadian couple who faced life in prison for hiding what they believed were pressure cooker bombs outside the British Columbia Legislative Building in 2013 on Canada Day were freed last month after a judge ruled that they were entrapped by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. John Stewart Nuttall and Amanda Marie Carotti were the victims of an elaborate police sting. Justice Catherine Bruce of the Supreme Court of British Columbia found that the police had initiated the terrorist plot and coerced the couple. We speak today with John Nuttall's attorney, Marilyn Sanford, about the case and the involvement of the Canadian Security Intelligence Services. Marilyn Sanford works in private practice in Victoria, British Columbia. She represents clients facing criminal charges and advances civil constitutional claims. Marilyn Sanford, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure, and congratulations on your victory. But first, let me ask you a little bit about yourself. Tell us something of your background and how you got involved in this case.
Sure. I'm a criminal lawyer in Vancouver and have been practicing for many years. I also do constitutional litigation, civil litigation, constitutional litigation, other types of cases. And this was a case where I was brought in. The lawyer who originally acted for Mr. Nuttall was looking for another lawyer to get involved and asked around, and I got involved. And then he later on left the case. He didn't practice in Vancouver, and the commuting was getting to be difficult. So it's just the beginning. It was perhaps just like any other criminal file that happens to fall into a lawyer's lap, but became apparent very early on. It was quite an extraordinary case.
Well, when did you decide to raise the entrapment defense, which is not usually a successful defense and a rare one? What was the background to that, and why did you decide to use that?
Well, as soon as I read the details of what had occurred here, it struck me very strongly that this was a very, very clear-cut case of entrapment. And the way the Canadian system works is, and I'm not sure if it's the same in the U.S., is we actually have to go through the verdict in front of, in this case it was a jury trial, and it's an issue that's raised formally post-verdict after the convictions are entered. So I think within days of taking on the file and starting to read it, it was apparent that that's what we were going to be doing. And the reason it was so apparent was because our facts were so unusual. It was a sting that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had put together targeting my client and his wife, who were two sort of lost souls living on the margins of society, recent converts to Islam. And the sting was ultimately a very powerful and manipulative technique whereby they were befriended by RCMP officers who were undercover and pretending to be a very powerful terrorist organization. And through months and months of efforts, they brought our clients kicking and screaming, really, to the point of placing what they were told were explosive devices on the grounds of the provincial legislature in British Columbia.
And they did that on Canada Day 3 years ago, July 1st.
Yes. The day was picked by the police. The timing was picked. The location was picked. The nature of the devices was all selected. The court ultimately, or trial judge ultimately, in the entrapment hearing agreed with us that our clients actually played a very minor role in all of this. And the reason they played a minor role was they simply weren't capable of committing or doing any act of this nature. They didn't have the skills to do the planning. They didn't have a driver's license. They basically lived within a four-block radius of their very modest little apartment. They had been homeless for a period of time, but at the time the police met them, they had a little bit of security in that they had a little apartment and a cat and lived with my client's now 92-year-old grandmother, but they really didn't have the wherewithal. They were espousing jihadist views, so there was that quite legitimate reason to attract the police interest in them, but the judge found that once once the police agents had spent time with them, they ought to have concluded that these were people who needed assistance and who were not truly planning or taking any steps to commit any crimes.
Yeah, the judge ruled that, quote, the defendants were the foot soldiers, but the undercover officer was the leader of the group. That's quite amazing.
It is quite amazing, and there was an added element because the undercover officer was not only the leader, but my client viewed him as his religious, that he was the religious disciple of the lead undercover operator. So there was a religious component in that the undercover police officers were in the face of my client espousing very strong reservations about whether the faith allowed acts of violence, terrorist violence. The undercover officers were steering them away from seeking religious advice from an imam or going to a mosque or finding it elsewhere, and espousing a view of the faith that was quite alarming, and that they were telling them that there's no point in worrying about whether this is right or wrong. It's all predetermined anyway. So very deterministic and dangerous misinterpretation of the Islamic faith at all, and this continued up until the night before the event, when my client was really going through an anguishing spiritual crisis as to whether this should happen. They also isolated them from their family members and other people. The police isolated the client so that they didn't have that resource either. So a frighteningly powerful technique. One that, of course, is used in the United States. This is the first time in Canada in a terrorism case that this has been attempted, and it didn't pass muster in our country, but it unfortunately does. The courts have thus far allowed similar techniques to go forward in the United States.
Yeah, I'll say. The judge, in her opinion, said, without the police, it would have been impossible for the defendants to carry out the pressure cooker plan. So what was the trial like?
The trial was extremely bizarre. The everything was videotaped and wiretapped surreptitiously. So in our clients' homes, there were taps, and in the cars where they met with the undercover agents, there were taps, and the undercover agents were body packed. And then they took our clients on fancy holidays to away for weekends away, and treated them to restaurant meals, and introduced them to a lifestyle that they were unfamiliar with. But all of those hotel rooms were bugged and videotaped. So we, on the defense side, it was a rare case where rather than trying to have evidence excluded or thrown out, we were putting the evidence in because these tapes were so compelling. So a huge amount of the trial was defense evidence rather than state evidence, and us playing the tapes. The prosecution in front of the jury wanted to focus on the last couple of days of what happened, but we wanted to show the months and months that preceded that. So it was a strange trial. It was in some ways rather comical because of the ineptness of my client and his wife as far as their ability to do even simple tasks that were being assigned them, and the frustration of the undercover police officers was often very evident, but also very tragic to see people being targeted like this.
You know, it's really pitiful. I mean, I read one article that said that your clients really preferred to stay home and play video games.
There was no question about that, and that's what was so frightening about it all, that this sting was designed after a considerable period of just surveillance of our clients, where the police learned exactly that. They basically stayed home, watched video games, spent time with the grandmother, went out to the coffee shop to buy coffee and cigarettes, did very little, a little bit of paintball occasionally, but did very little else, had very narrow lives. We're not associating with terrorists. We're not going to the mosque. We're not participating very much in their faith in an outward way. And ultimately, it was learned they were not communicating online with terrorists or through social media. So there was none of that going on. And then to see this technique imposed and successfully imposed on these people, it was quite disturbing.
I understand that this was the first successful entrapment defense in Canada. Why do you think that is?
It's not the first successful entrapment defense generally. It's usually a defense used in low-level narcotics matters, where it does succeed from time to time. It's the first terrorism case in North America where it has succeeded. I think part of the reason is in the American jurisdiction, there's over the decades, the U.S. Supreme Court had debated whether in entrapment cases, the focus should be on the conduct of the state agents or on the targets or on the mental state of the targets. And essentially what the court had debated and the majority of the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently said, we want to focus on the defendants. If they're predisposed to commit the crime in question, then we don't think entrapment should succeed. And a minority of the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently said, no, we should be focusing on the conduct. And is the conduct wrong? Because if it's wrong and if it goes too far, it shouldn't matter whether it's targeting someone who may have a predisposition. So the courts in Canada took up that debate a couple of decades ago and decided to have a Canadian law on entrapment that is more consistent with what the U.S. Supreme Court minority view was, which was let's focus objectively on the conduct of the government, because if the conduct goes too far, then you shouldn't be allowed to entrap someone just because they're predisposed. If the conduct goes too far, it goes too far, period, and that should be the end of the question. So I think the Canadian authorities perhaps didn't appreciate that the distinction there, because I think in our case it made a great difference. If we'd had a trial, this trial south of the border in the U.S., and if they'd had to look simply, the court then would simply have looked at, I'm simplifying the law a bit, but primarily would look at whether my client was predisposed, the answer would have been yes. And then based on that predisposition, then the entrapment would have been allowed, just as it was in the Newberg case, which is the most, I think, well-known of the similar type sting cases. In fact, the Newberg case out of the Bronx, which is where convictions were entered for an FBI-generated sting to bomb some synagogues and some military infrastructure as well. The courts, if you read the decisions in that case, some of the judges were very concerned about the conduct of the state, but nonetheless they felt that they had to follow the law, of course, and the entrapment law in the U.S. Doesn't quite match up with what we now have in Canada.
Yeah, well, I wish we did have what you have in Canada. I remember that case very well, and it was really a disgrace. In the United States, fear is used consistently in politics. In fact, when President Richard Nixon retired, a reporter asked him what the key was to his political success, and he didn't hesitate. He answered, it was fear, and they don't teach you that in the Boy Scouts. And we've seen that fear being used quite successfully in this country ever since 9/11. And I wondered what the situation is in Canada with respect to the use of fear to manipulate the population.
Well, I can't say it doesn't happen. I think it does happen here, but it's much more muted, and it's much more balanced, I think. And I don't like to generalize, but we, of course, didn't go through the experience of 9/11 on our own soil, so we have a different experience that we're bringing to the table. But just to give a tiny insight into the difference in the two cultures, when my client was released from custody, he and his wife just last Friday. He and his wife returned to the very city, Victoria, where this plot allegedly occurred, and they moved back to the same neighborhood, neighborhood very close to the scene of the fake offense, the fake crime. And their first day, they're very apprehensive about what the public reaction would be to, you know, all these convicted terrorists are now walking our streets. And what they found was that they had about 20 different people approach them. They're very distinctive looking. My client's about 6'5". His wife's very small and wears a hijab. About 20 people approach them on the street, and the reaction of every one of those people on the first day was, welcome to our neighborhood, congratulations. A few people hugged them. I don't know if that could ever happen in America.
Well, I remember growing up and hearing about the Canadian Mounties, and that their motto was, we always get our man. Are they going to get their man here? What's going to happen next? Are these people truly free?
They are free for the moment. They were rearrested immediately. They got out of custody after being in custody for 3 years. They went for lunch with their mother and some other family members, and then were rearrested in dramatic fashion on the street of Vancouver. That was on an application to have what we call in Canada peace bond, so to have not criminal charges, but to have terms imposed on so that they're being monitored, So we're going to have, they then got re-released on pending a hearing on that, which is going to occur in September as to whether they pose a risk of committing terrorist acts and should have terms imposed on them.
Well, again, congratulations, Marilyn.
Thank you.
And good luck to you in the ensuing months. Take it easy.
Thank you very much, Michael. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.